I can speak from personal experience, and I think this is a commonly shared experience, at least in youth, that one of the things that prevents us from getting a good night's sleep, from getting to sleep on time, is the mistaken belief that a party is about to show up. That's certainly a problem in college. I would stay up. I don't want to miss something. What if something incredibly funny happens at 2 in the morning, or someone shows up with a band? So one of my favorite comics, Dave Attell, kind of encapsulates this fear of missing out in a pithy phrase. It's always 10 minutes after you leave when all the fun shows up. And he goes on in graphic language to describe the bacchanal that arrives after you leave the party. And I think we struggle with putting life aside, slowing down, stopping, taking silence. Our sages weren't unaware of this problem. Now, their life was slower. They were blissfully without smartphones and electric technology. Of course, they also died in their 30s from lack of vaccines, so it's a trade-off. But I think the value of Shabbat has always been an easy separation of life into spheres of work and diligence and spheres of slowness and silence and meditative contemplation. We've done an exercise in a couple of classes I've taught trying to find the Ten Commandments. So if you look at the passages in Deuteronomy and Exodus, there are some 13 to 16 verses and sometimes 13, 14, or even 16 verbs. So isolating and identifying which are the 10 is actually more challenging than you think, and I don't think such a self-evident proposition. In fact, our sages even had a glimpse of this in one of the oldest strands of Midrash. So we're told in Exodus that 6 days you shall labor, you must labor, and on the seventh day you shall rest. So one of the oldest Midrash, the Mechilta, the Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, says that's two commandments. You have to labor, and you have to rest. Both really important. And as I've pointed out in the past weeks on Shabbat, mitzvot don't have a hierarchy. So work is important, just as Shabbat is important. Shabbat, we're understood, we're told, is a matter of life and death. But that's in the same passage as work, which suggests the inherent tension in Sabbath observance. It's a very interesting phenomenon. Does anyone have any Christian friends who talk about Sabbath? No? I guess it's just pastors. They talk about taking Sabbath. For some reason, they seem to do it on Friday, which I don't want to correct them, but... Wrong, yeah. And Jack Welch, the former CEO of GE, had the same idea. He would call it blue sky time, when he would just stare out the window. To be refreshed, to be truly productive and industrious and diligent at work, one needs moments of repose. One needs separation for the mind to recalibrate. There's even neurology and neuroscience behind this. To recalibrate, to find its creativity. For me, that happens on a bicycle. For many, that's in the shower. But Sabbath is partly there to inculcate that level of mindness and awareness and creativity in each and all of us. Now, I debated when to give this sermon because I realized I really wanted to give the sermon I gave yesterday, but I realized today I'd be giving this Shabbat sermon to a bunch of people who observe Shabbat. So there's not as much proselytization as I might like today. But I'll give you some tips and some thoughts and try to dig down into the function and the meaning of Shabbat, which I think in an era where a lot of Jews pursue Eastern religion as an avenue to mindfulness. You have Jubus, Jewish people who were born Jewish or became Jewish in life, and then later transitioned to Buddhism. I can think of friends and family in this category. And again, I'll point out, we have mindfulness too. It's just obscured under layers of folkways, pathways, and halakha. One of the prime examples to me is prayer, of course, study, but most of all, Shabbat. It's there to remind us that we are not slaves to our mobile phone or the television or the car. And in order to do so, it's the strange paradox of in order to have rest, one must work hard. That it's not just the 6 days of labor in the office, at the clinic, in the school. It's also labor in order to have Sabbath. The classic story of you got to get everything in the crock pot so that you have something to eat on Shabbat. It requires grocery shopping. It requires cooking and cleaning. It requires planning ahead. Because short of living in Shabbat observant communities, it's very hard to drop in on people. And that's what is needed. As with any great event planning, when we do our challah, when I went on a bike trip, when you have a date, you got to think ahead. You got to plan. If you want the date to be as romantic as possible, looking at a lot of married people. But, you know, think back when you were courting. Yeah, you do have dates in marriage, God willing. But you have to plan. You can't just say, God, I really like this young man. I'll decide what we're going to do when he shows up. You think of a nice movie or a nice cafe. Likewise with Shabbat, it requires foresight. To be truly reach a meditative state, one needs to clear out the environment and set the groundwork. Chizkuni, the French exegete of the 13th century, looks at Vishamru, the passage in the book that I was analyzing, and notes that Israelites have to have Shabbat in mind for the whole 6 working days, looking forward to it, preparing for it, in order not to need to desecrate it when it comes. Those of you, and you're many, we're very fortunate to have a very observant and knowledgeable community, know Wednesday you got to do your shopping. Tuesday, I mean, you often have to invite people weeks ahead because they get plans. You have to plan your cooking and clean the house and get everything ready because in an ideal world, you're not cooking. You're not shopping on Shabbat. You are living in the moment. That's the trick. And that anticipation, that storm before the calm, it's really cool. It's really spiritually elevating. So in the Talmud, we're told about Shammai the elder, who may have been the Shammai of fame or may have been another. And he would always eat in honor of Shabbat. There are many stories about this, about buying one's finest clothes and only announcing them, only wearing them for the first time on Friday night. So if he were in the market and he found a really delicious-looking goat or chicken, he'd grab it on a Tuesday, purchase it on a Monday, I guess, or Monday or Thursday typically, and set it aside for Shabbat. He wouldn't eat it on Wednesday. And then, it says in the Talmud, if he found an even better one, he'd eat the first one and set the second one aside. I mean, it sounds delicious. Yeah, exactly, right, yeah. So it gives you an excuse to have chicken a couple times. And so out of this tradition, the school of Shammai says, from the first day of the week, which is, of course, Sunday in Jewish calendar, you prepare for Shabbat. Doing anything right when you get there doesn't happen by accident. Great worship services, looking for Mary Ann, require long checklists. Atul Gawande has a whole book about the checklist manifesto. And we do. We have to prepare not just for Shabbat, but for so many things in life to make them click. There are very few things in life that come with that kind of ease and you can just wing it. A play, if you're in a play, you will have improvised moments where you lose track of the music or the words, but so much time goes into rehearsal. And to make Shabbat powerful, to give us those moments of rest that I want to address, requires this dramatic period of preparation, forethought, foresight, and frankly, anxiety and anticipation. To reach calm, even if it's as something as a 10-minute meditation, you have to set a comfortable chair, turn your phone off. Likewise with Shabbat. But Rashi says, writing in about the 11th century, the other trick is when Shabbat comes, you change your mind. It is in your eyes as though all your work were done, and there should be no thought of working. My mother tells me that one of my uncles used to say, once you make a choice, make it the right choice. None of that idea. You've set yourself up, now do it. And don't let yourself be dissuaded from it. Just a few tips. I try not to be too solvey as a rabbi. You know, you should always listen to people when you're in your office and not try to solve their problems. But these are good little tips that I found along the way. The easiest way to do that, I think, to really remove the thoughts of working, the first three things I would recommend, if you're not doing them already, turn off your phone, your computer, and your electronics, or at least don't communicate with them. Put them aside. Put down your wallet. It's another good sort of in a hierarchy of steps. And don't carry, this is my rabbis, don't carry any more than is absolutely necessary. So the literal lightening of your load can truly lighten your spiritual load on the Sabbath. So once you've done all that, that hurried work of getting ready, the unplugging of the phones, the unplugging, the turning off of the email, what is it there for? Our sages understood some of this, but I think it's all the more so in this modern era where the phone seems ever necessary and email feels like it has to be answered within 15 minutes. It's a moment to slow down. Y'all know, aside from teaching me the word y'all, I came here pretty much a type A. I was very quick. I owe a long overdue apology to Jeff Becker. I think it was the very first year I said, can you do your haftarahs faster? And thank God I came to the South. Because I needed that. I needed to be reminded that real life, good life, happens slowed down. The Israelites exited Egypt b'chipazon, with speed. But maybe the message of that is nothing else should be done in that way. The ability to sit still, the ability to sit quietly, is nearly lost in our world with the cacophony of noises and busyness and obligations. The ability to sit quietly and play Pokemon with your kids. I guess not all of you have five-year-olds. That's what I did this morning. Blaise Pascal says, apocryphally, that all of humanity's problems stem from humankind's inability to sit quietly in a room alone. As I mentioned yesterday, fellowship is such a key virtue and value for Jews. But nonetheless, the ability to sit and sit quietly, some of you are good at it. I've never been good at it. I think one time I was at Minyan and I mentioned that I can fall asleep if I have, even if I have an allergy pill that's really speedy. What's that called? It doesn't matter. And Margie Goldman, who's a medic, what, Benadryl? Margie Goldman says, of course you do. You have ADHD. I don't know about the AD. I can focus. I can attend to people, but I can't sit still. And I know people like that. I'm not the only one. And then that quieting. You know, there's such a human impulse. There was a scene in Pulp Fiction that got cut where they're saying to each other, are you a person who listens or just waits your turn to talk? I think if we were doing a poll, I think 90% of people would be the wait your turn to talk. And the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot says that Shimon used to say, all my life I grew up around the wise, and I learned nothing better for a person than silence. It's amazing, right? If you're ever put in a situation that I find myself in often where you're listening to someone go through some real strife, you can't think of what to say, saying nothing is always a good idea. It's just a powerful moment. Silence. So wherefore all this maddening preparation that I spelled out to you, this planning of what brisket you're going to buy and when you're going to put it in the hot pot and who's going to come over and where you're going to sleep and what lights you might leave on or record the basketball game, what is the value of that? I'm going to back up, and I think Terry Lee might have taught me this, but I've heard it before. The difference between anxiety and excitement, there's a lot of the same physiological responses, but with anxiety, your breath is very shallow, and with eagerness, your breath is much more profound. With that in the back of your mind, I want you to think about, there's a famous idea in our tradition that on Shabbat, you get the second soul, right? It's a second soul comes to you on Shabbat. It's a Kabbalistic, it's actually from Talmud, so it's much older than that, but it's a mystical idea. To me, it always felt like there's a ghost. I didn't like it. So Reish Lakish says this in a couple places in the Talmud. On Shabbat Eve, the Blessed Holy One gives the human a neshama yitera, and I don't want to translate that yet. And at the close of the Shabbat, God withdraws it. I can tell from faces, oh, that sounds really nice, but it's always sounded off to me. So I found this really great translation in Sunsino, those red books we have in the library, and they're also on DVD-ROM. And neshama, I'll leave untranslated, but yitera, which we often think of as additional. In one place in the Sunsino, they call it expanded rather than additional. And neshama, spirit, comes from the root of breath. So what I want to tentatively suggest is what really happens on Shabbat is that your breathing slows down. So necessary. And to go back to the idea of Judaism having mindfulness practice, that's most of mindfulness meditation these days, is just breathing slowly. It's what you teach small kids when they can't sleep well. Slow down your breathing, count your breath. It's what you do if you're anxious and you have a project come up, you slow down before you get paralyzed. So with all that frantic energy that precedes candlelighting, the point of those 25 hours, I think, from candlelighting until full dark on Saturday, and also our holidays, is that deep breath, just time to breathe. Time to breathe expansively, the neshama yitera, the deeper breath. Without sounding too new agey, but I think that is a piece of it. Just simplicity. Shabbat's not so complicated. Meditation isn't that complicated. It's really about engaging in sensory experiences rather than cognitive and productive experiences. Specifically, we call it melacha machshevet. The things you can't do on Shabbat are called melacha machshevet, thoughtful work. The things effectively that change your environment. The phrase when you go camping is leave only footprints, take only memories. That's sort of the motto of Shabbat if you were to look at the Mishnah. Don't do anything that modifies the natural world. Change your environment as little as possible aside from inhaling oxygen and exhaling carbon dioxide, which is a different problem for another sermon. And it doesn't end there. So the first third of my sermon was about up until candlelighting, and then I wanted to talk to you about Shabbat itself. But if it were only to give us those 25 hours of rest and fullness of breath and contemplation, silence, seatedness, settledness, that wouldn't be the point. Religion, Judaism, I mean, there are many problems with religion and its abuses and uses, but religion, in my heart, is there to transform us. If you're not transformed occasionally or slowly by the experience of coming to a shul, of studying, of observing Shabbat, of observing kashrut or prayer, maybe you should do something else. Maybe chess is for you, but I don't think so. I think if you do it right, Judaism is there to transform you, body and soul. So Rashi says that the point of this rest is that you regain your soul and breath. That you may. I mean, we've had synagogue events right after Shabbat, go out to see a movie, something fun like that, a synagogue event right here, and you rush out, slap your clothes on, go back to the movie theater, go out for a dinner date with a friend. But if you've done Shabbat adequately or in as much as you can, even when you get to the movie theater, hopefully, you're still in a certain space. And from that space, and I think frankly from everything, you know, I've mentioned my experience of kashrut was to tell me that I could not eat certain things and survive, which I didn't know because I'm a chazer. And a lot of people's experience of turning off their phone for 25 hours is to make them realize my phone's just a technology. It's just a piece of electronics. It's not another appendage. We do by slowing down, by pausing, by resting, by preparing, we come to new ideas and new perspectives on the 6 days that precede and the 6 days that follow. So Levi Yitzhak of Berdichev is a late-ish 18th century Hasidic master. He wrote the Kiddushat Levi. And I've noted to you before that our sages like to use bad etymologies to make points. So I didn't even catch this one. He compares Shabbat to Shuvah. So Shabbat is rest or sitting, and Shuvah is repentance. They're not connected exactly etymologically, but that shouldn't stop you from a good sermon. And so Levi Yitzhak says that the repentance we get on Shabbat is recognition. Recognitions that the objectives that we pursued during the 6 working days were in the main the pursuit of transient values, as opposed to the enduring values that Shabbat is there to help us pursue. When a person observes Shabbat properly, that spiritual uplift will leave its mark during the 6 days following. I mean, you think, I told this story recently, that I was in Minnesota on my bike trip. So I was 22, wow, half a lifetime ago. And somewhere between Fargo and Minneapolis, we hit a thunderstorm, horrible downpour, and we pulled into a convenience store, shivering and hungry, and someone took pity on us and said, do you need a place to stay tonight? This happened a few times, but, and she said, well, I'm just a mile away, and she told us how to get there, and it turned out it was like this vacation home for a fabulously wealthy and wonderful couple. She had been, I think, an executive vice president for Pac Bell, one of the Bells. And I was asking her about her career, and she said, you know, being in a high-pressure career is a little bit like having your hand in warm oatmeal. It feels really cool while you're in it, like a very pleasant sensation. It feels really significant and all-encompassing. And when you stop, all you have is schmutz all over your hand. And I think that's Shabbat, right? You think what you're doing on Thursday is so important. And then you pause and you sit with your loved ones. You have a relaxing meal. You take a nap. You read. You come to shul. You take a walk. See the birds. Spend time with your kids or your parents. And you realize that's really what matters. That's really what matters. Representing your clients, caring for your patients, working on one's art. Those are important things. And again, each rest and work are both mitzvot, which is not to denigrate either. But you wake up a little. So Lawrence Kushner, who's I think now in the Bay Area, and his son was in youth group with me, in his book Honey from the Rock says this, I thought really cool. Shabbos is more real than Wednesday. Jerusalem is more real than Chicago. The sukkah is more real than a garage, and staka is more real than income tax. Judaism, we know, is a very rooted and concrete and not abstract, but very embodied and incarnate religion. Most of our mitzvot, there's almost no mitzvah that is about things that happen that you can't see. But those actions, Shabbat, Kashrut, all of the mitzvot, charity, laws around Lashon Hara, are there to remind us that these things of the Western world, these constructs around us, these things that we think are important, are not the, at least not the only things that matter. That there is deeper truth, that there is something less transient that we need to adhere to, seek out, and inhere to, have it inhere in us. Here's a quote from Elwar that you're going to help me find. There is certainly another world, but it is surely in this one. That's Judaism, right? There is another world, but it inheres in the one we know. And that the whole value of Shabbat and, frankly, the panoply of Jewish practices is to, through our physicality, through our work, our rest, and our restoration, remind us of what truly matters. get ready, rest, restore, and repeat.